We've heard that the practice of Zen and studying the way is fundamentally, basically, for clarifying the nature of mind. The nature of mind is inconceivable. Some of us might be happy to know that the nature of mind is inconceivable. Is it possible to clarify that which is inconceivable? Maybe there's some aspects of the inconceivable that can be clarified. One aspect of the inconceivable nature of mind that we can clarify is that this nature of mind is inconceivable. We can clarify that. If we feel like we got any conception of it, any conceivable grasp on what it is, then we can know that that's not quite it. So we can clarify that. And yet we, of course, starting with the Buddha and through all of these 28 generations of ancestors in India and a bunch in China and Japan, they seem to talk a lot, even though words are kind of concepts. They seem to try to point more and more closely to that which can't be pointed at. Because if we don't say anything, then the status quo rules the day. Our usual dualistic conceptual mind is all we seem to know. So we carry on with our usual distorted thinking and just appreciate that there's some mystery in the background somewhere. So I think we can go further. We can, once we clarify that the nature of mind is inconceivable, we can also, we can clarify that it's empty, which is almost the same thing as inconceivable, really. It's empty of any graspable ideas about it. It's empty of any graspability. Sometimes that's how I think of this word emptiness. We hear emptiness a lot, right? Around Zen halls. So you might wonder, empty of what? I like to think of it as, by emptiness we mean empty of graspability, which is almost like inconceivability. The nature of mind is empty, but we could also understand its emptiness as having no boundaries, edges, location, dimension, coming, going. For example, these are all actually concepts. These are actually conceivable. Edges, boundaries, locations, comings, and goings are all actually conceptual constructs that we can kind of get a hold of an edge, can't we? We're talking kind of mentally, knowing an edge of something. But edgelessness is, we can't get a hold of that. So when we speak of boundless and centerless and locationless and timeless, these are all other ways of expressing inconceivability, but they're kind of They're expanding our appreciation of the fullness of inconceivability, actually. Those are all sort of what the nature of mind is not, right? It's not a location, it's not a particular place, a particular time. So I feel like all those descriptions of it, qualities of it, are all pointing towards its inconceivability. And then the other dimension of the nature of mind is that it's, according to Kazan and these ancestors, at the same time as it's completely ungraspable, unfindable, empty of center, edge, and time and space, it is bright, knowing. Now that's where some people might start to feel like, whoa, wait a second, that sounds like something. That sounds like something. Something maybe conceivable, or it's not just a negation at this point, right? It's clearly aware, the nature of mind. But this clear awareness is not something we can grasp either. And we can explore how could it be that the nature of mind is both empty and clear and awake at the same time, and that these two aspects of it are not separate. It's more like an empty awareness or an aware emptiness. It's the complete inseparability of emptiness and awareness. And it's something that we can consider. This explanation is coming packaged in concepts, words, so they never quite hit the mark, right? As the second ancestor said, I am always, or there is always constant clear awareness, but words can't reach it. These words don't reach it, but they direct our inquisitive mind towards looking. We usually would think of something like complete ungraspability and unlocatability and these emptiness aspects as something separate from knowing and awareness. It's hard in our conceptual mind not to separate those into two different aspects. But we can explore this experientially. These words are encouraging us to explore in our own zazen. There's an awake alertness that's completely ungraspable. And if we want to add in a third aspect of the nature of mind, it's unimpeded. It doesn't resist anything. Unimpeded means like nothing can impede it, like space. Like if you try to punch space, grab space, insert something into space. Nothing impedes it. This space that fills the room is unimpedable, isn't it? And this unimpededness means that this nature of mind can display itself as anything whatsoever. If it were somewhat impeded by some states of mind or thoughts or something like this, then we might feel like this nature of mind can display itself as only good thoughts. But it's so free and unimpeded that it can display itself as anything. However, we can say its natural expression, when it's not obscured by the dualistic conceptions of a sentient being, then its natural expression is love and compassion. Equanimous love and compassion for all beings. Love in the sense that it's an all-embracing unity. It finds no separation between me and you, therefore we can call that love. And it finds no resistance to the suffering of the world, so therefore we call that compassion, that is willing to feel the suffering of the world and respond to the suffering of the world. It's unimpeded by suffering, unimpeded by all beings, and it's unhindered in its compassionate, loving response. So that's a little different now than, sounds a little different than just pure inconceivability, doesn't it? But these are just natural qualities of inconceivable, boundless awareness. I think if we just talk about emptiness as the absence of any graspability, that, I don't think that has compassion. That's just the fact that nothing really exists. Right? That's like the second turning of the Dharma wheel. That's the Heart Sutra of Prajnaparamita. There's no eyes, no ears, no nose. Even though the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion taught this sutra, it's not really emphasizing love and compassion. It's more pulling away any conceivability that we're holding on to. In the third turning of the Dharma wheel, we bring in this aspect of awareness. Emptiness is, when we're speaking of the nature of mind, is also aware. And therefore, the awareness makes compassion possible. If we don't see any other, if we don't perceive any other beings, if we don't perceive any suffering, then how could there be compassion? We need awareness for compassion to operate. And we need emptiness for compassion to be unhindered. So the nature of mind is inconceivable, and these words don't reach it. I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to explore the stories of the first six Chinese Zen ancestors. We're finishing now with the sixth. Sometimes they are like they're like the founding forefathers or something. They're like these six are like the birth of what we call Zen, right? Beginning with Bodhidharma. Of course, it was Zen all through India back to the Buddha, but it wasn't recognizable until Bodhidharma. And all Zen houses and schools up to the present day all share these six ancestors. After the sixth ancestor, the streams and lineages of Zen branch out into thousands and tens of thousands of different styles right after the sixth ancestor. But everyone shares these six in the Zen house. So we'll finish with the sixth. dajyan huenong daitan eno daiyosho. Lived in the 7th and 8th century. Dajyan or daikan means great mirror. Both the third and the sixth ancestor have mirror in their names. These early ancestors are, they are the mirror. Do they have a name? They have names, but they're not ordinary names. Their names are mirror. Their names are Buddha nature. And Huenong Eno is means a great capacity, a great ability, or wisdom ability. The 33rd ancestor, China's sixth ancestor, was Zen teacher Dajian, great mirror. He worked in the rice hulling shed at Huangmei, or the rice husking shed at Huangmei. And as one footnote of, you know, Zen people trying to say how the process of rice hulling goes on, says it like this, but, you know, they might not know all the details. This footnote says that brown rice is partially hulled and white rice is completely hulled or husked. Liz, would you agree with that?
I don't know.
I have heard that, previously heard that brown rice, no rice has the husk, you can't eat the husk, but brown rice has the germ. And that's what makes it super healthy, the rice germ and fiber, maybe. Anyway, this note says brown rice is partially hulled or husked, and white rice is completely hulled or husked. Would anyone like to refine that explanation? Anyone know about rice hulling? Yeah. 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 So I think, so white rice and white flour, they remove the germ, which is not the husk, but,
what is it?
I don't know. So in that case, that would make sense that it's super nutritious, right? That's why health nuts like brown rice. But brown rice has only become popular, as I understand it, in modern Western world. In the old days, white rice was like primo. So pure and easy to chew. Yeah, that's one story I heard, yeah. So.
No, I mean salted, you know, in growing up, salted food that was preserved with salt. That's probably what that is.
So, I like to eat white rice, even though I know it's there's not much in it. Because it is.
I've had two helpings
at once. Ah, there we go. It was delicious white rice today. They were, what an auspicious day to have white rice when we hear this story. Interesting. I know there's also brown basmati. And of course, in modern Asia, China and Japan, in India, China and Japan, rice is the staple. And brown rice is virtually unheard of. Everybody does white rice. And I learned about it way back. This is in the 600s, right, in China, and way before that, right? But apparently one of the footnotes also says in that time period in China, hulling of rice was done in a stone mortar with a foot-powered pestle. Like you grind up the rice. And I don't know, it would be, if anyone ever finds like a diagram of how the foot-pedaled pestle works, it might be like a bicycle. But there's one story that's not in here that says that Huino, maybe he had stone sandals or something, and he's doing it with his feet, literally like his feet in the mortar. And in that story, he's a small guy, so he ties this big rock on his back to get more traction. Sometimes you see pictures of Huineng with the rock strapped on his back to weight him down, and maybe holding poles and moving his feet. I don't know, but I have this picture, this photo here. First of all, I have a photo. These are from my trip to China 19 years ago. This is the fourth ancestors temple on East Mountain. And this is this giant Dharma protector that's being built. You can see how the temple is almost completed, but they were rebuilding it after the Cultural Revolution. And on the back, some of you know Scott Lowe. He practices in our sangha here. He was on this trip with me, as well as Santa Cruzian Rosie King was on this trip, and Tay and Elliot Roberts. Tay's no longer with us. And these are these giant outdoor incensers. Anyway, that's the fourth ancestor's temple. Don't have pictures of his stupa up on the hill. And then the fifth ancestor, which is this story here on Huang Mei. This is a photo of the rice pounding room, rice hulling room at the fifth ancestor's temple in Huang Mei with Tenshin Roshi standing by the mortar and pestle. And you can try to see if you can figure it out here. He looks like he's trying to figure it out. I think someone was maybe trying to explain in Chinese how this worked, but there's these poles with hand things, and there's like some kind of, you can see the mortar. And is this the actual mortar from the 7th century? It's stone. And it's this special room for rice hulling. And of course there's a statue of Huineng and offerings at the mortar. You can see there's flowers offered at the hulling mortar, because this is the story that happens at the mortar. So great mirror Da Jian worked in the rice hulling shed at Huang Mei. Once Zen teacher Daimon Konin, the fifth ancestor, entered the shed at night and asked, "Is the rice white yet? Is the rice polished yet?" And Daikon Eno answered, "It's white, but it hasn't been sifted yet." The fifth ancestor took his staff and struck the mortar 3 times, and at that point Daikon Eno took up the sifting bamboo sieve for sifting and shook it 3 times. Shook, shook, shook. And then he entered the fifth ancestor's room for the transmission. That's the story this afternoon.
There.
It's interesting. I feel like with the 6 ancestors, now these koan stories start to get stranger and stranger from here on out. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was this the guy that wrote the poem?
Yeah.
That wanted to be a successor.
That's right.
He thought he was going to be.
That's right.
But this ignorant rice pounder.
Yeah. 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 We can hear some of the story. Mm-hmm. The Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. So one sweet footnote says that, some later commentator says that the pure white rice with all those unchewable husks removed is like pure Buddha nature when all the covering defilements, afflictions of conceptual thinking and greed, hate, and delusion are all husked away. What's left is the pure white Buddha nature. And actually, it just occurs to me that I think, for example, in this Parinirvana Sutra and other sutras, they sometimes use this very metaphor for Buddha nature. They have a lot of different metaphors for it. The hidden, pure reality of Buddha nature covered or hidden within our conceptual thinking and habitual patterns and so on. And so it's just a matter of, I think all these metaphors point to, it's fully complete, but it's just covered or hidden by these, it's obscured by these obscurations. And this is one of the metaphors, I think, I forget if it's rice, but it's like a husk on grain. It's like the grain inside the husk is like Buddha nature. And there's other things like, like gold ore that's still in the, the pure gold, but it's still covered with the mud all around it. These are metaphors for Buddha nature. And that so hulling or husking is like this work, the hard, long work of grinding our Buddha nature that's all mixed in with our obscurations. And so they start to separate. As we've been talking about this week, we see that they're never really separate. Like the images on the mirror are never separated from the mirror, right? But the work is to clarify the nature of mind. We can clarify the relationship between the reflections and the mirror. This is a metaphor, but clarify in our own experience. When a greedy thought arises, what's that thought's relationship to the boundless awareness from which it arises? It's not separate from it, and yet we can distinguish the two also, can't we? This is why this kind of clarification, I think, is especially helpful to use this mirror metaphor. The mirror metaphor is all metaphors are limited, but the mirror metaphor is particularly nice for exploring the relationship between delusion and awakening, between obscurations and Buddha nature, between reflections on the mirror and the mirror itself. Kind of say they're not two and they're not one. But it's very similar, the way that reflections don't touch the mirror, and yet they're inseparable from the mirror. The obscurations don't actually touch the Buddha nature, but they're inseparable from it. The husk of the rice grain isn't woven all through the rice grain. It's just covering it. And yet, until they're husked, they're inseparable. So husking, you could say, is like starting to discern the difference between the husk and the grain. But as the husking process happens, as I would understand it, then you have this mortar full of pure grains all mixed in with the husks, right? So then there's the second part of the process is called sifting, maybe a bamboo sieve. And so the story is saying, is the rice white yet? Is it husk? Have you discerned the difference between the husk and the rice? Yes, the rice is white, and in fact, it always was white inside those husks. And now you can see the white rice there, but it's also all mixed in with the husks. We start to see the Buddha nature, but it's all mixed in with our thoughts about it, and our all our habits are still seem to be all scattered about the Buddha nature.
How can you distinguish?
Well,
how is not all that Buddha nature? That's where
it yes, can... its nature is all Buddha nature. Yeah.
All the husk, everything, mm-hmm. all our thoughts, everything.
Yeah.
Start even moving into mm-hmm.
Well, the nature of the husks, now this metaphor is starting to break down, but the nature of our obscurations is pure Buddha nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they manifest as obscurations. They seem to obscure it. That's why, for this very question, again, the mirror metaphor is very nice. We might say, well, how are the images in the mirror not the same? Aren't they really the same? But in that metaphor, just to take it as a metaphor, isn't it a beautiful way to say that, yes, we can't really say that the image is something separate from the mirror, but we can say, this is the image and this is the mirror, right? That's what I mean by discerning. And it's helpful to make that conceptual distinction, because if we don't, then we again fall back into this kind of like, well, it's all the same and we just go about our usual things, or we're discerning without actually separating anything. So sometimes we call the obscurations impure, but you're exactly right that their nature, the nature of the obscurations, the true nature of the obscurations is pure. But what we mean by impure is that which seems to hide the all-pervading love and compassion of our Buddha nature. Anytime we don't have a love for all beings, then you could say that's a seeming to obscure our Buddha nature.
It seems to, but it is Buddha nature.
Yes.
That
yes.
It seems to be obscured.
Yes.
Buddha nature.
And if we know that, then we have a different relationship to it, right? To our obscuration. So this kind of clarification is, I think, exactly what Keizan means by the practice of Zen is fundamentally for clarifying the nature of mind, which we're doing now in discussion, but main thing is in our own experience, clarifying. So sifting, once there's some, we can kind of tell the difference and the non-difference between rice and husk, then we can sift it. And so what does the sifting mean? It might mean that, like, over a long time, the actual, the husk that's not really needed anymore starts to drop away, and we actually, like the greed, hate, and delusion, even though they're pure, well, we can actually sift them out. We don't really need them. That could be the process of sift after hulling, then sifting. Hulling may be like, we see the greed, hate, and delusion are not the most natural full expression of Buddha nature, even though they are an expression of Buddha nature. And so that we can sift and actually just let them go. For the Buddha, not only did the Buddha husk his greed, hate, and delusion to remove it, separate it from the Buddha nature enough so that he could see the difference, but instead of just staying there and being like, well, it's all non-dual since the greed, hate, and delusion are Buddha nature, he said, well, that's true, they're non-dual, but We don't actually need these greed, hate, and illusion. So let's just sift them away. So there was no more greed, hate, and illusion for the Buddha. You could say it's like a further step.
They're not the most skillful.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And as the love and compassion become more and more revealed, we feel like, I'd like to do some sifting here. So that fifth ancestor says, is the rice white yet? Have you done the hulling? Yes, it's white, but it hasn't been fully sifted yet. Well, come into my room and we'll finish the sifting. The master's family name was Lu, Workman Lu. His ancestors were from Fan Yang. Huineng's father died at a young age, and his mother took care of him. While he was growing up, the family was very poor, and he helped him and his mom earn a living by chopping and selling firewood. One day, he went to the city with a bundle of kindling, and he heard a customer reciting the Diamond Sutra, the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And when that customer reached the place where it said, give rise to the mind of no abode, Huineng was awakened. It uses that character Satori here. He had some understanding. Satori is not just a Buddhist term, it actually just means to perceive or to awake or to understand. Maybe that's the best. It's just a colloquial Chinese-Japanese term. It means to understand or perceive something. But in Zen, it takes on this awesome meaning, especially if we leave it in Japanese. Did they have Satori? But in Japanese, that would just sound, they understand? Kensho. Sho is this sho we were talking about this morning that means nature and sounds the same as name. Yeah, seeing the nature of mind, seeing Buddha nature. And Dogen wasn't so fond of that term Kensho, although he occasionally uses it. I think just because it's a little bit problematic to say Ken, which is to see. He was more like, usually if we see something, it's something that we see, right? I think that's his problem with it. So he used the terms like manifest nature. It's not the key thing is not so much to see your true nature, or nature of mind, Buddha nature, but to manifest it and express it. It's Dogen's emphasis. So Huineng understood when he heard give rise to the mind of no abode, or you should give rise to an unsupported thought. That's another translation. He asked the customer, what sutra is this? Where did you get it? And the customer said, it's the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and I got it from Zen teacher Hongren at Huangmei. And this is one of the longest chapters in the Denko Roku, so I'm going to skip around, but you can read it your own. You can also read it most of this is in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, which some of us have seemed like looked through a lot. The Jewels in the World group is reading another commentary on the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. So anyway, there's a story here that's not in the Platform Sutra where people start to realize Huineng's wisdom, and they restore this old temple, and he starts teaching in this temple before he meets the fifth ancestor. Yeah, in this story. And lots of people came, and the Dharma was flourishing, but one day Huineng said, I'm seeking great Dharma, why stop halfway? He knew he wasn't complete. I gotta look for more teachers. That's an interesting twist on the story. And the next day, he leaves and starts asking people where to find Zen teachers. And somebody says, go to Huang Mei, to the fifth ancestor. So he went directly there, and the fifth ancestor said, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Ling Nan, which is like this kind of barbarian land down in the south, right? And where rough, uneducated characters live. And the fifth ancestor said, what are you looking for? And he said, I just want to be a Buddha. And the fifth ancestor said, well, people from Ling Nan, down in that barbarian land, have no Buddha nature. How could you expect to be a Buddha? And I think we could understand the fifth ancestor was maybe just testing him, because that's a ridiculous statement. All beings have... What? Yeah, to see if he would get mad, get his goat. because all beings have Buddha nature. So, or he wanted to see what he would say, maybe. So what he said, Huineng said, well, among people there are northerners and southerners, but there's no north and south in Buddha nature. And the fifth ancestor realized that he was an unusual person, so he sent him to the rice hulling shed. No, not the woodshed. He was an expert woodcutter, but he's like, he knows how to cut wood, but he's got to learn rice hulling. It's hard work. The other monks around here, they just like to sit zazen, and that's okay too, but I can see he's already got a deep understanding. He's done a lot of zazen in former lives, so now what he has to really do is discern the subtle difference and non-difference between the rice and the husk, between the mirror and the reflection, between the Buddha nature and the obscuration that's made out of Buddha nature. Why don't you go to the rice hulling shed? Huineng bowed and left. He went to the rice hulling shed, where he toiled at the mortar day and night without let up for 8 months. The fifth ancestor, realizing that the time had come for passing on the Dharma, told all the monks of the monastery, the true Dharma is hard to understand. Don't just pointlessly remember what I say and make that your responsibility. I want each of you to compose a verse that shows what you understand. If the words display the truth, I will confer the robe and the Dharma. This is the famous poetry contest. So, Shen Xu, the senior monk of the assembly, felt like, well, I think I'm destined to be the next successor, so I better write a poem, but I'm actually terrified to do it, because what if it's not right? This story said every time he went to tell in Dokusan to recite his verse to the teacher, he broke out in a sweat and he couldn't do it. And he tried 14 times, the story says. And so finally, that's why the it was written on the wall, right? Because he couldn't do it in Dokusan. So he's like, I'm gonna actually anonymously write my poem on the wall, and I just can't stand to do this face to face. It's too much. The pressure is too high. So much test anxiety. Oh man. And the fifth ancestor was testing the assembly.
Didn't that make it obvious that he wasn't ready to be a successor?
Sounds kind of like it. So, and he says, like, if the fifth ancestor says it's good, then I'll say that I wrote it. And if he says it's bad, I'll just leave the monastery and go off to the mountains and maybe even just forget about Zen practice and become a dishwasher. So, secretly he's thinking this, right? And so that night at midnight when no one could see him, he wrote on the wall of the south hall his understanding. And the famous verse, the body is the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. The mind is like a bright mirror on a stand. Polish it over and over and do not let the dust gather on this mirror. We could hear that as a nice Zazen instruction, right?
Kind of like the Han verse.
Yeah, polish over and over.
Don't waste time.
And in Zazen we could see it as, yes, we have this mirror-like Buddha nature, and when a thought arises, polish it. Like, you better drop that thought. Don't we often try to polish away all our thoughts, and we kind of feel like if I could just let go of all thoughts and have just a pure mirror free of all thought, that would be the best. Don't we sometimes think that? I think that's what the fifth ancestor, or that Shen Xu, the senior monk, thought. And the fifth ancestor was walking around and saw this verse on the wall, and he knew it was Shen Xu's, and he praised it, saying, everyone should practice in accord with this verse, and they will get excellent results. It's kind of a result-oriented verse. Polishing is kind of like we're trying to come up with the result of a polished mirror. So he made everybody memorize it. Meanwhile, Hui Neng is just pounding the rice, but he heard somebody reciting it because they all memorized it. Yeah, just polish the mirror over and over. All these people wandering through the rice telling them, polish the mirror over and over, don't let dust land. And he was like, what are you guys saying? And one of the monks said, don't you know? Our teacher's looking for a Dharma heir and everyone has to compose a verse about mind. Shen Xu came up with these lines and our teacher praised them highly, so he'll surely pass on the Dharma and robe to Shen Xu. And Hui Neng said, well, how does the whole verse go? So the monk recited it, and Hui Neng said, it is really excellent, all right, but it's not quite perfect. The other monk shouted at him, what does a simpleton like you know? I like this Francis Cook's translation here. Don't talk crazy. Don't talk crazy. Wei Neng said, well, can I just add a verse to it? And the student just looked at him and laughed. That night, Wei Neng took one of the young novices with him and went to the hallway and lit a lamp and had the novice write this verse next to the other verse because Hui Neng was illiterate and he couldn't write. His verse is, Bodhi, awakening, fundamentally has no tree. The bright mirror has no stand. From the beginning, not one single thing exists. Where can the dust gather? The name of our Shoda Harada Roshi's commentary on the Platform Sutra we're looking at is called Not One Single Thing. It comes from this verse. So there's still a bright mirror in this verse, but this mirror has no stand. It has no support. It has no nothing that's holding it up. It's and Bodhi, awakening, has no tree. It has no location where it happens. It doesn't happen under the Bodhi tree. It doesn't happen. It's everywhere. From the beginning, not a single thing truly exists. So where can dust gather? So on this mirror, there's reflections of dust and reflections of turds, right? But because they're just reflections, they don't soil the mirror. And because they're reflections, they can't be wiped off the mirror, right? Because this dust that appears on the mirror, what is this reflected dust made of? It's made of the mirror, right? If the dust were made of dust, then you could wipe it off. But if the dust is just a reflection on the mirror, you can't wipe it off. And you don't need to wipe it off because its nature is pure mirror, which I think is Richard's point here, right? That dusty delusion must be itself Buddha nature too. It's a more non-dual expression where there's nothing to achieve or to wipe away.
And expressing the realization of emptiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Not one single thing, not one speck of dust truly exists, but many specks of dusts and turds and trees and walls, tiles and pebbles are reflected in this mirror, and the mirror doesn't mind. 10,000 things appear to exist on the surface of the mirror, but they don't actually exist. We could say it as they don't exist as something separate from the mirror. They don't exist in and of themselves as wipeable dust. But they look, because this mirror is inherently very clear, they look exactly like dust.
Unwipeability.
Yeah. Part of clarifying the nature of mind is the nature of mind is unwipeable. It has the quality of unwipeability.
So, what does that say about our practice? I think both of them are right.
Yeah, I think both of them are right too. One's a more conventional practice that it is actually helpful to let go of thoughts. I think the first wiping the dust away, we could say that's the practice of when a thought arises, let it go. Yeah. Very helpful.
Or hauling the rice.
Hauling the rice, yeah. And the second poem is more about when a thought arises, just see its nature.
In that story, I always wondered why that second guy got more credit than the first, because I thought they both spoke truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you see how the second one is a little bit more non-dual? Non-dual means it's not like there's somebody who has to do something, and it's not like something's pure and something's impure in this case. It's more radically about non-doing. Sometimes they talk about it. Zen is like non-doing, but it is about understanding and clarifying. Sifting, yeah. So, but it's true. They're both good. They're both good verses. But as Huineng said that too. This is a good verse, but it's not quite complete, right? And the teacher, I think he was honest when he said this is an excellent verse. But when everybody else saw this verse in the monastery, they said, this is the verse of a living bodhisattva. Everybody praised it. But the fifth ancestor knew it was Huineng's verse. And he said, whoever wrote this hasn't yet seen his original face. And he erased it. Why did he do that? Because there's something about this secrecy thing here. He didn't want to cause a stir. He's like, temple politics can be rough. Maybe this is part of it. And we know this is all, things are going along like this. Shenshu's going to be the next ancestor. And it would cause such a ruckus in this monastery if the rice hauler, Huainan, who's never even been to the Zendo, was to become the sixth ancestor. Oh man.
And he's illiterate.
He's illiterate. He's a lay person. He's just
little.
He's little, and he's from the south.
But it's what happened anyway.
Yes. No. Listen on. During the night, the fifth ancestor secretly went to the rice hulling shed and asked, "Is the rice white yet?" It's white, but it hasn't been sifted. So then teacher struck the mortar 3 times, maybe emphasizing, confirming, yes, it is white. And then Huainan said, "But teacher, don't confirm me too quickly. I have to sift it. Please help me." And they entered the ancestor's room. They entered the room. Now I'm going to skip like several pages of story here.
What happens in those several pages?
Well.
Running away.
Yeah. All that part.
So in his room,
Yes, he conferred the robe and bowl at midnight and said, "You better go now before the monks wake up." And that fifth ancestor, rowed him across the river. And, there's some wonderful stories in here when one of the monks who used to be an army general, heard story of this, they're like, "That Huainan must have run off with the robe and bowl. Let's get it back." And the chase scene ensues. And they all like chase him up the mountain and catch up. And when they get there, this warrior monk is like, "I thought I came for the robe and bowl, but actually I came for the Dharma." And the sixth ancestor says, "Well, without thinking good or bad, just such a time, what is your original face?"
Did he try to pick up the bowl or something?
Yeah, he tried to move it and realized he couldn't. It was stuck to the rock. And then Huainan went and hid amongst the hunters, It's a number of years. It doesn't say. That's right. Well, I think it was like he would live with the hunters, and they would cook their beef veggie stew, and he would pull out the beef and just eat the veggies. Okay. There's a little vegetarian plug in there in the Huainan story. So then various other stories, you can read about them. It goes on for pages here. And then eventually his students gathered the talks of, it became the Platform Sutra.
Okay.
Yes.
What would you say the significance is of his responding to the master's tapping 3 times with the sifting 3 times?
Well, like I say, maybe it's saying, I still have, the student saying, "I still have some sifting to do." The 3 strikes with the staff could sound kind of like, kind of a confirmation. After I say the rice is white, the teacher says, non-verbally confirms, "Very good." And then Huainan, the student, says, but wait a minute. Shuk, shuk, shuk. And I'm not quite finished. Could be like that.
Why did he get doubt? It seems like he wasn't sure of himself.
Yeah, just like earlier, right? He was like the teacher at this monastery with all these people, and he still felt like, it's not quite complete for me. And that's when he began his true practice. So I think it's a great quality of, even then, he felt like, I want to plumb the depths to the very bottom. I want to clarify every detail, leaving no stone unturned, leaving no rice grain unhusked. Yeah, which he did then too after that, right? Spent years in the mountains before coming out. So I think it's emphasizing the thoroughgoingness. And also I think it's emphasizing the teacher-student connection here of like, there's a kind of silent accord that without speaking any words, there's just three strikes and three shakes. But kind of like together, let's clarify this. And in the platform, some versions of the Platform Sutta, they talk about what's said in their conversation in the room, just before the Dharma is transmitted. We could hear it as thoroughgoingness. Because doesn't it seem pretty good to just husk the rice and it's pure white already? Maybe the fifth ancestor already felt like, that's great. And you wrote a great verse, so let's do it. And Huineng says, not quite yet. Student says, not quite yet. Often it's the teacher says that, right? So let's, partly maybe because they hadn't really barely met before. Huineng was spending all his time in the rice hulling room, so kind of like, let's do some sifting together. Yes?
Is it possible that first, the white rice part is referred to the first verse and the same thing is referred to the second?
That's a nice interpretation. Could be. Yeah. He said, could it be that the first verse of Shen Shu was the first verse that Shen Shu wrote, the first poem, is kind of like hulling rice, and the second, slightly more complete verse of Huineng is like sifting the rice, the last little sifting. It's kind of like that. It's like, it's just the final completion, right?
Could that first part also be the Tensho?
Kensho is a glimpse, but not complete. Okay. Yeah. Kim?
Yeah, I feel like I have, like, similar experience with that, and it's, like, I recognize that on the natural quality of the mirror, like, being completely clear, and then, like, I'll hear, you know, birds or something, like, I'll hear noise, and they're completely separate. Like, it's really like meditating. It's like, I hear it, I see, and then I see the natural quality of awareness, and then I hear that. And I'm like, why are they separate?
Yeah, so that's the work of discerning. You can examine your own experience and from all different angles to try to discern if they really are separate. Maybe they just seem separate because we're used to thinking that the sound is over there. But maybe not really separate.
So, I feel like there's something there that's gonna like help me. I mean, listening to the story, it seems like, you know, the sifting, you know, it's like he received the transmission correct in the story. So it's like, I feel like it's really similar. So what do I need to do, you know, to,
you can really examine
that last little thing.
Yeah. And maybe just keep sifting. And hulling and sifting, and this is a long, endless process to clarify all the details about separation and non-separation, and what the difference is between them. And so, and this can happen in lots of conversations. Maybe
it's better if you can hear it and not be startled by it.
Maybe, but being startled is also okay. Being startled is also part of it. Yeah. So, at the age of 75, Huineng died while sitting in dignity in Zazen. I think all six ancestors died either sitting or standing. When, now Kazon says, when the transmission took place, like water passed from one container to another without a drop being spilled, Hongren asked, is the rice white yet? These grains of rice are surely the marvelous sprouts that will become the sovereign of Dharma, the life roots of both sages and ordinary people. Once planted in wild fields, they grow even without weeding. Husked and polished, they take on no impurity. However, though this is how they are, they're still unsifted. If they're sifted, they pervade inside and outside, and they move up and down like sifting in a sieve. The grains move up and down, but also like Buddhas going up to nirvana to realize awakening and then coming down to benefit beings. When the mortar was struck three times, the rice grains separated spontaneously and the functioning of mind was suddenly revealed. When the rice was sifted three times, the Dharma of the ancestor was transmitted. Since then, the night when the mortar was struck has not brightened, and the day of transmission has not darkened. It seems that Huineng was a woodcutter from Lingnan and was workman Lu in the rice hulling shed. Even though he had not studied the ancient teachings and illuminated his mind, still, just by hearing one sentence about the mind of no abode, he finally ended up in the rice hulling mill with mortar and pestle. Although he never practiced Zen, raised Dharma questions, or discerned awakening in the usual way, by working diligently for 8 months, he illumined the mind as a bright mirror which has no stand. In the middle of the night, the transmission took place and the life vein of successive ancestors was transmitted. Though it was not necessarily the result of many years of effort, it is clear that just a brief period, he exhaustively clarified the details, attaining the way by all Buddhas cannot essentially be measured in terms of long or short periods of time. How can you grasp the transmission of the way by ancestral teachers through such distinctions as past and present? And then Kazon finally finishes, this is the end of a practice period in the year 1300 in the summer. These 90 days of practice period, I've spoken of this and that, commenting on the past and the present and explaining the lives of the Buddhas and ancestors with vulgar words and gentle words. I've gone into the subtle and fine, which words cannot describe, and treated you all like dear sons and daughters, grandchildren, and more defiling the wind of the house, the Zen tradition, and displaying our house secrets. I've done this. kind of shamefully displayed our house secrets, just spouting it all out like this. Consequently, we may think that we have penetrated the principle and gained some power, but we don't seem to have completely accorded intimately with the intentions of the ancestors. Our behavior is not at all like that of our wise predecessors. Because of causes in past lives and great blessings, we've been able to meet here face to face. If we single-mindedly endeavor in the way, we will realize the way, but many of us have not yet reached the other shore. We may have still not peeked into the profound heart of the matter. It has been a long time since the Buddha passed away. We've not completed our work in the way, and life is slipping away. So why wait until tomorrow? Summer is over and fall begins. You will be taking off in all directions soon, leaving for Sacramento and Monterey and Acapulco. South Santa Cruz. And scattering here and there, as we always do at the end of a retreat. How can you recklessly memorize a word or half a sentence and call that my dharma, or hang on to a piece of knowledge or half an understanding and think this is the way of the Mahayana? Keizan's practicing at Daijoji, which means great vehicle temple or Mahayana temple. So how can you say these bits and pieces are the way of Daijoji? Even if we have gained some power sufficiently, the secrets of our family are still exposed. How much less should we teach the Dharma pretending to be something we're not and spouting nonsense? If we really want to reach this realm, let's not vainly waste time, day or night, pointlessly lugging around these minds and bodies. That's his admonitions at the end of practice period. It's been great, but it's not finished. It's never finished until all beings everywhere are completely free and joyfully in accord 24/7. Final verse of Keizan. Striking the mortar, the sound is heard, echoing beyond time and space. Sifting the clouds, the bright moon appears, and the night is deep and clear. Thank you all for your sincere practice. Diligent attention and stable zazen. It's truly an inspiration to this world for all of us to be doing this together. And any positive effects of this sesshin, of this transmission of light assembly, we gather together and we don't hold on to, because that will just diminish any great blessings and merit. Instead, we, with our power of our deep intention, we offer any openness and joy we might have gathered throughout the entire universe in 10 directions, radiating the light to all beings everywhere, so they may be completely free and at ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.